Hey everybody, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another edition of the MTB Strength Coach Podcast. I've got a few things on deck for you today. First up in the nutrition tip, I'm going to talk about soy protein. In my last podcast, I'd mentioned offhand why soy protein isn't a good protein source and had gotten a few questions on that, so I wanted to go into that a little bit more detail as to why, in general, you want to avoid soy protein and how it got introduced into our food supply and why it's not a good choice for us. In the gear review, I talk about DT Swiss's 1750 wheel set, and I've been running these wheels on my bike for the last couple years and have just been amazingly impressed with them. So I wanted to talk about them and give you my feedback and my experience with them, and also squelch some of the rumors out there regarding their rims being soft or something like that. Like I said, every once in a while I hear this pop up, and I don't know where that came from, but I've never experienced anything like that. So just give you some feedback and experience with those and why I think they're such a great wheel set. In the training tip, I talk about how to make your lightweights feel heavy so your heavyweights will feel light, and basically how to reprogram your nervous system so that you take control of your strength levels and that you're not relying on some sort of external stimulus to tell you how strong to be and how that's going to take your strength levels to new levels. And then lastly, I've got a kind of a new section I think will pop in every once in a while. My random rant, as most of you know, have been following me for a while. I've been known to go off on tangents and do some rants on stuff, and trying to keep things a little more positive with those. But every once in a while, I got something I just kind of need to get off my chest, and in this one, I basically talk about why road biking and mountain biking, from your body's perspective, have almost nothing in common, especially like road biking and things like downhill racing. Like, we have the luxury of looking at things from the outside in, which I don't even really know is a luxury. And whereas your body, when it's looking at it from the inside out, views it completely differently, and why you can't just cut and paste a program from road cycling into a mountain biker's program and expect for it to deliver the best results. So just kind of talk about why that's not a good idea for you. So I got plenty on deck for you, so let's get to it. In this podcast supplement tip, I want to go over soy protein. In my last podcast, I talked about protein in general and had just mentioned offhand that soy protein isn't a very good protein source and that people should generally try to avoid it. And that definitely got me some questions. So I realized that not everyone is quite up on the history of soy protein consumption in the Western world and in the United States, and how it got introduced into our food supply, and why it's not necessarily the same thing that is used in Asian countries. Soy protein is a plant-based protein source, and so it's billed as a quote-unquote healthy protein source. You find soy protein in like soy protein supplements, but soy protein is also the main ingredient in tofu. And so the first thing that you need to know is that the soy that we consume in this country is not the same thing as the soy that they consume in Asian countries. And there's two fundamental differences between what we do and what they do with their soy. The first thing that the Asians do is they ferment the soy. When they do that, and I'll get into this here more in just a second, it diffuses some of the potential negative side effects of soy consumption. And the other thing that they do is that they use soy as a side dish, not as a main food source. You're not going to find Asian countries consuming, tofu turkeys and soy dogs and stuff like that. So, the old saying that, a billion Chinese can't be wrong, and pointing to the soy consumption in Asian countries as a rationale for the soy consumption in our country, you got to understand we're talking about apples and oranges, really. That, what they do with their soy is not what we do with our soy. So, first, a real quick history on our soy consumption. Soybeans are used by farmers to restore nitrogen levels in the soil. And so, you know, after they're done, you know, harvesting their crops, you know, traditionally they would come in and plant soybeans. You know, that would, you know, provide a ground cover, which one would help prevent erosion, and two, the soybeans actually add nitrogen back into the soil, which makes it richer. Well, what happened was farmers had all of these soybeans, and so, you know, they're trying to figure out what can we use these things for. Instead of just throwing them away, there's got to be some way that we can make money off of these soybeans. So who can we sell them to? What can we use them for? And the first thing that they did was started using them in animal feed. And the problem was they started to notice that the more soy that they fed to their animals, the more reproductive problems those animals started to have. In fact, now you'll find that there are laws that give you a maximum amount of soy protein that you can use in animal feed. They're actually protecting the animals from too much soy consumption because of the negative side effects that they found from consuming too much. So, well, after they got kind of turned back in the animal feed market, they turned to human consumption and started looking at ways to turn soy into something that humans would eat, and how can we package this and market it in such a way as to make humans want to eat it. And so, you know, that is literally how soy became introduced into our food supply. Now, soy protein has a very low biological value, meaning that it's not very usable by our body for a couple reasons. The main reason is that it's missing some essential amino acids, meaning again that you know those essential amino acids are things that our body can't produce, and so we have to eat them from outside sources. And so, you know, proteins like whey protein and animal proteins that have all of those essential amino acids are much more usable by our body. And so when you eat a gram of whey protein, your body is getting more out of that than it does out of a gram of soy protein. The other thing that soy protein has going against it is what's called estrogenic flavones. And these are basically things in the plant, in soy protein, that mimic estrogen in the human body. Your body looks at these and confuses them with estrogen. And so this can really mess up your hormonal feedback loops in your body if you're consuming large amounts of unfermented soy protein. And this is where the fermentation came in. The fermentation that the Asians have developed basically neutralize these estrogenic flavones. And so these estrogenic flavones for men, you know, our body works on what's called a negative feedback loop, meaning that what it does, like when you produce some testosterone, a certain amount of that testosterone is going to be converted into estrogen. And you know, every guy has estrogen in his body in some level, and obviously it's you know pretty low levels, but it's there. But what your body does is monitor those estrogen levels in order to tell it how much testosterone you're producing. And so it knows how much of your testosterone is being converted to estrogen, and so it monitors that to keep track of testosterone production. So if you start consuming a plant based protein source that contains these estrogenic flavones, your body is going to confuse those as being an increase in estrogen. And its reaction to that will be to lower testosterone output. Your body doesn't know that you're consuming this from an outside source. It thinks that it is producing too much testosterone, which is why you all of a sudden have this large, you know, increase in what it perceives to be estrogen. And so its way of dealing with that is to slow down testosterone production. I mean, I hope I don't need to go too far into why that is not a good thing. You know, the messing with your hormone levels on that like that, especially an anabolic hormone like testosterone for hard training males is, you know, just it doesn't work. You know, that makes your nutrition actually start working against what you're trying to accomplish with your training. So, you know, that is really the main reason that soy is not a good protein source. It's just a very low quality protein, and it contains substances that can literally screw up your hormone levels. And this goes for ladies too. Like, you don't, you know, your body monitors, estrogen levels in ladies. And so you don't, basically you don't want to trick your body into thinking that it has more estrogen than it really has, because it's going to react to that in a negative way. And so that's why soy protein isn't very good. But it is an amazingly cheap protein source. And so that's why you find it everywhere. So you need to be careful and read those labels. You know, watch what you're eating. You'll be surprised at what you find soy protein in. Now, real quick, I do want to point out that soy lecithin is not the same thing as soy protein. So if you see something that has soy lecithin in it, L-E-C-E-T-H-I-N is how you spell lecithin. If you see something that has that in it, it's not the same thing. So, you know, if it doesn't have soy protein but it has soy lecithin, then generally speaking that'll be all right. So, so that's really it. You know, again, when you understand that soy protein is not something that we naturally consume, especially the processed stuff that we consume in the Western world, and that it was really, you know, introduced based on what can we make money off of this doing and marketing hype and stuff like that, as opposed to like an actual need and real science, you know, you can start to see why soy protein isn't such a good idea. So, that's basically it in a nutshell. You know, soy protein gets billed as being valuable in a lot of ways. I know, you know, somebody pointed out that, you know, some company is, you know, saying that, you know, because, you know, soy protein is, digested slower than whey protein, that makes it a good protein source for, you know, extended rides or something like that. But again, that is marketing hype. That is somebody trying to figure out, how do I package this in a way to make it attractive to mountain bikers and cyclists? It's not actually based on any real science or evidence or anything else like that. So just got to beware of the marketing forces and things like that that are trying to make money off of us and don't necessarily care what the end result is. You know, I mean, the food industry in general is a pretty shady, corrupt industry. Really, in my opinion, on the level of what the tobacco industry was like a few decades ago, as far as like putting poisonous things into our food supply in order to make money off of us, and not really caring what the end result of the poisons that they're introducing in our food supply are. So, just got to keep that in mind. Be a little paranoid about things. You know, look into it. And again, if you don't believe me, you can, you know, do some research. There's actually a really good article on a website, t-nation.com. If you do a search for soy protein, you'll find a bunch of articles on, you know, why it's not a good protein source and some of the things that I've talked about here, and, you know, put together by people much smarter than I am. So I'm sure they go into it in a lot better detail. So again, you know, don't just take my word for it, do some research. But, you know, I think that you'll be shocked when you do and you kind of find out what the real truth is behind soy protein. So the take home message is, don't eat it. It's not good. It's not good for any of you. And you need to avoid it. Read those labels. Make sure that it's not in your protein supplements. You know, don't buy into the whole tofu dog, tofu turkey thing being healthy for you. And you'll be much, much better off for it. So hope you guys have enjoyed this. Definitely probably giving you some fuel for thought and your protein sources. And I will talk to you guys in the next supplement tip. Hey, everybody. In this podcast gear review, I want to talk about my favorite set of wheels for my trail bike, the DT Swiss 1750s. DT Swiss is located here in Grand Junction. And so, you know, get a chance to actually go in and see the facilities and meet the guys there. But beyond that, I've been riding their wheels for the last couple years, and I just have to say that I'm amazingly impressed with the wheels overall, but especially with the 1750s. And, you know, the 1750s, the reason they're called 1750s is they weigh 1,750 grams, the set does. So they're a pretty light wheel set. They're actually, you know, the first like real high quality lightweight wheel set that I've had on my bikes, and it was like the first time that I noticed a really huge difference. Like, you know, in pedaling uphill, it was like, whoa, there's definitely a difference with the, you know, with the how easy it is to pedal with this lighter wheel set. In fact, it took me a little while to get used to the lighter wheels and how to, you know, deal with them on the trail. And but the thing that really, really, really impresses me with them is, you know, one, how light they are, and two, how tough they are. And this is, you know, kind of a funny story that speaks to, one, how great it must be to be a sponsored rider and not really have to worry about what's on your bike, just knowing that it's the best equipment available, but also speaks to the toughness of these wheels. You know, one time I was talking with Aaron Gwynn, and, you know, the Yeti team is sponsored by DT Swiss, and we were talking about wheels, and, you know, he brought up that he really likes the white downhill wheels that DT Swiss makes. And I'm like, white downhill wheels? Like, what? Their downhill wheel set, the 2350s, is red. And talking with him a little bit more, I realized that he's talking about the 1750s. So, you know, you've got, you know, one of the top World Cup racers out there racing on these wheels. And so, you know, and complimenting them on how good they are and how well they hold up. And so, you know, that should kind of say something right there. But, you know, just beyond that, just my own experience, I've been running them for the last couple years. And, you know, we have some very rough, rocky, technical trails around here. And to be totally honest with you, I was a little worried as far as how well they were going to hold up. And I have to tell you that they have taken everything that I have dished out and more, and just keep coming back for more. And it's just, it's awesome to have a wheel set that, you know, works so well, and that you can just go out and ride hard and not have to worry about, you know, truing them up after every ride. You know, the other nice thing about them is that they use, you know, regular spokes. And this is something, when my buddy from Hawaii was visiting me, he had a pair of, I forget what they're called, the, you know, Mavic makes a wheel set that's in that 1750 gram range. And he ended up snapping a couple spokes. But, you know, they use like these really weird proprietary spokes that you can't find anywhere. I mean, we were literally looking every shop in town, you know, looking on the internet that we could have something overnighted to them. You know, we ended up having to pull out an old set of my wheels and putting on his bike because, you know, we weren't able to replace those spokes, and things were just getting a little sketchy for him there. So it's nice to have a wheel set that's that light and that durable, but also uses just regular parts, so you don't get stuck with, you know, something that's made of unobtainium and you can't find it, you know, unless you bring it with you everywhere you go. So, you know, the 1750s do come with bladed spokes, and at first, you know, I was a little concerned with that as well. Like, I didn't know how well those bladed spokes were going to hold up, and figured that I would just replace them as they started breaking. And, you know, like I said, I've been riding really hard for the last couple of years, and I think I've broken two spokes, and, you know, both of them were definitely like my fault, just, you know, mistiming something and blasting the wheel into a rock. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about, I don't know why it keeps coming to my attention. People ask me about this whenever I'm talking about these wheels. You know, for some reason, DT Swiss has gotten this reputation as having, you know, soft rims, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, maybe that was something that was in the past, but I can tell you from experience, both, you know, my using the 1750s and using their 2350s on my downhill and free ride bike, I have blasted the living crap out of those rims, and they are just fine. I mean, there's no flat spots, there's no problems with the rims. So, you know, again, I kind of wanted to just, you know, throw that out there, that if you know, you've been looking at DT Swiss wheels, but you've been a little deterred by the rumors of the soft rims and stuff, that you know, it's not necessarily true. Like, I almost have to think that some of those rumors were started by guys who ride real heavy and are going to blow up pretty much any rim. You know, again, if you're riding light and you're picking good lines, then it shouldn't be an issue. But even if you're not, like I said, I've taken some really bad lines through some really rocky sections and had no problem. Like I said, you know, maybe busted a spoke once or twice, but you know, nothing beyond that. So just a really tough wheel set. You know, they're not that expensive when you compare them to comparable wheels in their in that same area. You know, they are a little more expensive than the super cheap wheels, but you know, you get what you pay for. And you know, again, having something that's going to last a long time and is going to you know, be high quality, something that you can easily find parts for, is just, you know, a pluses all around. So I just kind of wanted to give a shout out to DT Swiss and especially those 1750s. You know, if you're in the market for a new wheel set for your trail bike, you can't go wrong with those wheels. I can't recommend them highly enough. You know, you'll love them. They're amazing wheels. So that's about it. You know, I know there's other good wheel sets and stuff out there. So, you know, I'm not saying that these are the best in the world or anything like that. I'm just telling you my experience with them and, you know, hopefully giving you guys some more, info to make a good buying decision with when you are in the market for good wheels. But, you know, I will say that, you know, investing for years and years and years, I looked at wheels as one of those things. You know, they have a saying in the bike industry: cheap, light, and strong, pick two. You can't have all three. And for a while, I was definitely of the opinion that wheels were one of those things that were just go cheap and strong, you know, don't worry about it. And when I finally invested in a wheel set that was light and strong, not necessarily cheap, it definitely made a big difference. So, you know, it's one of those upgrades. You know, if you're looking for something to upgrade on your bike and you really want to feel the difference, you know, I mean, really, like upgrading from like an XT to an XTR derailleur, I mean, are you really going to notice that on the trail? You know, probably not. But you know, upgrading your wheels will definitely make a huge difference. And DT Swiss makes great stuff, and the 1750 is a great wheel. So yeah, that's about it for that. Hopefully, you guys have enjoyed this, and I'll talk to you guys in the next gear review. All right, guys, in this podcast training tip, I want to go over a kind of more of a mental trick that you can use to get stronger. And I've recently signed up for the RKC kettlebell course, the Russian Kettlebell Challenge, which has gotten me back into reading a lot of stuff that Pavel Sotsalin, the guy who introduced kettlebells and came up with the RKC certification, you know, here in this country, you know, his writings and stuff. And he was really one of the first people to turn me on to how the nervous system controls strength and how you can reprogram the nervous system in order to be stronger. And he has a book out called Power to the People, which is it's a great training book. It's a very simple, light read, but it has some very profound things in it. And one of the things that he talked about in that book was a saying that they have in powerlifting: if you make your lightweights feel heavy, then your heavyweights will feel light. And what that means is most of the time, most people will rely on an external load to tell them how strong to be. And so this is where you hear things like, you know, oh, that's not heavy enough, or, you know, that exercise is too easy, you know, I don't feel anything from it. You know, when I hear things like that, you know, and I get this a lot with my program, especially in you know, people who have been training for a while and they get my program, and, you know, the Ultimate MTB Workout Program, the Phase 1 exercises are definitely more like, you know, body weight based, you know, trying to work on developing body awareness and body control. But, you know, when you're coming from a traditional, you know, gym, you know, I got to lift as much weight as I can type background, a lot of people look at that and they go, oh, I'm too advanced for that, or, you know, that's too light for me. So, you know, I get emails from people saying, should I just skip to like Phase 2, or, you know, how do I make this heavier? I don't feel anything. This is too light. And, you know, I get it in my facility as well. And my answer is always the same. You know, I'm not impressed when someone tells me that they can't feel something from a lightweight or an easy exercise variation. What that tells me is that you don't actually have any control of your strength levels, that you rely on some sort of external stimulus in order to tell your body how to be strong. So it's the weight or the exercise that's telling you how strong to be. You're not telling your body how strong to be. So, you know, what I generally tell people is, you know, you need to look at it differently. You know, you have, you know, this many reps with this exercise in order to wear yourself out. Don't be just as strong as you need to in order to get through the exercise. Be as strong as you possibly can. Create as much tension in your muscles as you possibly can in order to wear yourself out in that, you know, number of reps with that exercise variation. And when you do that, you start to reprogram your body. You start to change the software that it uses for strength. And you just basically tell your body, like, hey, you know what? I'm strong all the time. No matter what I do, or no matter what exercise I'm doing or how much weight I'm lifting, I am strong all the time. I'm producing max tension all the time. And what happens is when you start getting to the harder exercise variations and you start lifting more weight, now all of a sudden they're not as hard because your body has just gotten used to producing the tension. Your mind has gotten used to the focus that you need in order to, you know, be strong with those heavier weights. So that's kind of the essence behind that saying, make your light weights feel heavy and your heavy weights will feel light. You know, always pretend that whatever you're lifting, whatever you're doing is the hardest, heaviest thing you can possibly do. I mean, you got to sell it. You got to be like a world-class actor in that regard. And like I said, when you do that, you're going to find that your harder efforts and your harder weights and your harder exercises are going to be much easier. You know, some of the strongest men in the world, you know, got their start using, you know, broomsticks in order to perfect their technique. You know, like Olympic weightlifters, for example, you know, most of the best in the world, again, started out, you know, and still use very light weights in order to, you know, grease the groove, so to speak, and practice their technique. But they also, like I said, they're making those light weights feel heavy. So when they get to those unbelievably mind-blowing weights, their body knows what to do. You know, you don't want to have one way of moving and being with light weights and then have another way of moving and being with heavy weights. It needs to be the same across the board. And so, you know, so that's it. And this is why, you know, I keep emphasizing in my programs and in my blog posts and these things, you know, the idea is not to go out there and find, you know, the fanciest, hardest variation of an exercise that you can. The idea is not to go in and pound the living snot out of yourself every time you go into the gym and think, like, if I'm not lifting the heaviest weights I can possibly lift and just, you know, blowing myself up, then I'm not getting any results. You know, in fact, like strength training, you know, a good strength training session should leave you feeling almost better when you're done than when you started. And so, you know, that is the essence of strength and movement. You know, really it comes down to how do you move, and if you're strong, you're strong all the time. You have the highest quality movement you can possibly have. You know, this is the other thing with, like, you know, setting up. You know, I see people, you know, when they're using a lighter weight, you know, they're not as strict with their setup. You know, they'll bend over and round their lower back to pick up a weight off of the ground because it's only, you know, quote unquote 15 pounds or something like that. But you know what you're going to do when you reach down to grab that 90 pound weight? You're going to round your lower back. Like, you know, what you practice is what you're going to do. And so that's why you got to make sure that you're always practicing tight form, focus, you know, maximum tension, you know, drill those things into your body with the, you know, with the easier exercises, or not easier, but, you know, the lower level exercises and the lighter weights, and then you'll have a much easier time being strong when things get heavy. So, you know, that's about it. I mean, it's a pretty short training tip, but it's really the essence of strength. You have to understand that strength comes from the neck up. And once you've mastered that, then everything from the neck down is easy. And so, you know, this is the essence of strength and movement and the physical culture that, you know, defined fitness before Joe Weider and bodybuilding and all the, you know, posturing and, oh, I lift more weights than you, and, oh, I work out 5 days a week. Oh, yeah, well, I work out two times a day, 5 days a week. And, you know, you got to remember that the influence that bodybuilding has had on our fitness culture. And, you know, even some of these, you know, programs and things that say that they're trying to get away from that mentality are still being influenced by it. That, you know, bodybuilders, in the absence of having a real competition, because again, I'm sorry, standing up on a stage in a pair of posing trunks is more of a pageant. It's not really a competition. And in absence of having like a real true physical competition, you know, these bodybuilders started competing in the gym with their workouts and who was working harder and who was putting in more time and who was lifting more weight. And so, you know, this is what they write about in the bodybuilding magazines. And so the message coming across to people is that, you know, if you're not working hard all the time and you're not lifting as much weight as you possibly can and going to failure and doing all these things, that you're not really training correctly, when the truth is that mindset and that style of training has been around for less than 100 years. And if you look at the physical culture and the way that people trained before Joe Weider and bodybuilding perverted everything, you'll see that training was a much, much different thing, and that, you know, no one was just walking into the gym and just trying to, like, you know, lift as much weight as they possibly could and going for the hardest exercise variations. There was, you know, a physical culture that people got into, and they understood that I have to establish, you know, these basics. I have to establish the mindset. I have to establish the control in the first place before I start advancing to these other things. So that's it, man. That's your training tip. Make your lightweights feel heavy. Your heavyweights will feel light. You know, if you're on my ultimate MTB workout program and you've been one of those guys who've been like, you know, 6 push-ups, really? Like, you know, I can bang out 50 push-ups. Again, I'm not impressed by that. You need to be able to do both. You need to be able to wear yourself out in 6 reps, and you need to be able to bang out 50. You need to be able to do both. And that will make you stronger, and that's the true essence of strength, because that means that you actually have control over your muscles. You're not relying on something outside of you to tell your muscles how strong to be. So there you go. Take that to the gym next time and put that to use and watch yourself get stronger as a result. So I'll talk to you guys in the next training tip.
So this little section is something I'm calling the random rant, and every once in a while I just got some sort of thing on my mind. I want to get off of it and share some thoughts on it. And anyways, this is something that's really bothered me, and really the thing that separates me from pretty much everyone else in the mountain bike industry is the influences on the programs that I write and how I look at mountain biking. And what I'm, you know, basically most of the influences in this sport have come from road riding. And I can understand why on the surface some of that might make sense. But, I mean, really, when you look at mountain biking and road riding, the two have almost nothing in common. I mean, to be totally honest with you, like, I personally look at, like, middle distance running and track and in MMA fighting to see what, you know, those athletes are doing as far as conditioning goes. To me, you know, for your mountain biker, again, I'm not talking about road riding on dirt. I'm talking about, like, actual mountain biking, like in the mountains or on technical trail, or, you know, something where there is a technical demand, not just a pedaling demand. Again, that's road riding, and you know, if you want to road ride, that's fine. But mountain biking is a different animal. And so if you mountain bike and you want to train to be a better mountain biker, then you need to understand where this is coming from. And the reason that I bring this up is, you know, this would probably, people would be surprised if they knew the people behind this, actually. But through various circumstances, I was talking with another guy in mountain biking who coaches riders. And, you know, I was just talking to him about some of the stuff that he does with his riders and the cardio program and stuff like that. But he told me that he had basically contacted, it was either the USA Cycling or the US Olympic Center or something like that, and gotten their cardio program, their training programs for track cyclists, because track cycling is the closest thing to downhill racing, right? And literally, this is where he was going to take a program designed for a track cyclist, someone who pedals a bike continuously, nonstop, around an indoor track going in the same direction every time, not a lick of technical skill involved in it. And he was going to use that program basically almost cut and paste with a downhill racer, which to me just makes no sense. Again, outside of the fact that they're both on a bike, not even the same bike, the bikes are totally different. They weigh different. The position that you're in pedaling is different. It's just, it's a completely different experience as far as your body is concerned. You know, us looking at it from the outside, we see someone powering a bike in both sports. Our bodies look at that. They don't have the you know, looking at it from the outside in, they're looking at it from the inside out. And to them, these two sports are completely different. They have nothing to do with each other. The positions are different. What you're doing is different. The way you're powering the movement is different. The energetic demands are different. The way the nervous system's creating movement is different. I mean, just down the line, there is nothing that those two sports have in common. And yet the greatest influence in training on downhill racing is just direct people directly taking programs from road riding and applying them to mountain biking. And so I want to reiterate this. Like, I talk about this, but I don't think that people really understand how literal the translation of road riding programs over to mountain biking has been, and how that's influenced our sport. And honestly, I think that's one of the reasons that road riding technology is, like, you know, bigger wheels and you know, clipless pedals. And I mean, these are things that are, these are road riding influences on our sport. And again, I'm not saying that they're good or bad, but one of the, when you train like a road rider, you're going to develop the fitness and skills of a road rider, and a road rider gains their advantage from pedaling. And so things like clipless pedals and bigger wheels all of a sudden make more sense because they're playing into the strengths that you've built from training like a road rider. And so if you don't train like a road rider, if you train like a mountain biker, if you work on your strength, you work on your mobility, you work on your technical skills, and pedaling is just a component of what you're working on, then you're going to ride differently. And all of a sudden, flat pedals and 26 inch wheels and a 6 or 7 inch trail bike, all of a sudden these things start making way more sense as to, like, whoa, I see what these things are about, because now my physical skills and my technical skills match up with what these things have to offer me on the trail. And so, you know, that's just kind of my thoughts on it. I mean, one of the daily battles that I'm really trying to fight is just help people understand that, you know, it's fine if you want to be a road rider on dirt, but they're not the same thing as mountain bikers. And if you want to be a mountain biker, you need to understand the difference between what you need and a roadie needs, so that when you're evaluating how to become a better mountain biker, you don't make the mistake that so many people make, which is to just look at what the road rider does or take a program and not recognize that it has a very strong road riding influence and follow it, as opposed to, you know, following a program for the unique demands of mountain biking. Mountain biking is a unique sport and it needs a unique training program. It cannot just take stuff from other programs, especially you can't Frankenstein monster stuff together. You can't, like, you know, take a cardio program from here and grab a strength program from there and, you know, grab like some stretches from another place. Like, everything has to be integrated and working together. You can't change one element without it affecting another element. And so, you know, that's what the difference between a program just having workouts, and people that follow programs get better results. And so, I mean, this is why pretty much everyone who's ever tried one of my programs, I'm not trying to brag here, but the truth is, you know, I've heard from very few people who have said that my programs didn't deliver results. And the vast majority of them just couldn't buy into it in the beginning and didn't even try it. And so, you know, if most people that try the programs get better at riding, you know, there's something there. I mean, the success rate with it is much higher than your average training program. And, you know, I think that's because it's hitting on those things that these other programs aren't, because it's not a road riding influence program. So, that's it. That's kind of my rant, you know, just, getting a couple things off my chest there. Don't know if you guys enjoyed this or not, but, definitely probably gave you some things to think about. So that's pretty much my point anyway. So, I'll talk to you guys next time.
All right, guys. Well, that does it for this edition of the MTB Strength Coach Podcast. Hopefully, you guys have enjoyed it. And like I said before, I really enjoy doing these things. Here in the States, we just got done celebrating Thanksgiving yesterday. So for those of you in the United States, happy Thanksgiving. For everyone else who's not in the United States, still want to say that I am thankful for the opportunity to help my fellow mountain bikers become better riders and enjoy riding more. You know, I have to say that when I came up with the concept for MTB Strength Training Systems, five some odd years ago, I had hoped that it would take me to this level, but I never thought that it would quite get this big, this fast. And like I said, I'm really grateful and to be honest with you, humbled at times when I realized like how many riders around the world are looking to me and MTB Strength Training Systems to help direct them on how to have more fun on the trail. Because, you know, really that's what it all boils down to is having more fun. And you know, if you're not having fun on the trail, then shoot, you may as well just take up fishing or something like that, I guess. Not there's anything wrong with fishing, but it's not quite as exciting as ripping some sweet single track. I'm definitely thankful for all of you guys and the opportunity that I've had to help advance training for our unique sport and introduce people to strength and conditioning for mountain biking and let them know why it's such a great thing and how it can help impact their riding. So speaking of which, I've got my ultimate MTB workout program. The new update version 3.0 is like 95%+ done. I'm still working on shooting the videos for the skills drills, but everything else is done and I've actually got it up. If you go to ultimatemtbworkout.com right now, you can purchase the new program. I'm doing a special. When I'm done with everything, the price is going up to at least $147. I've got it for $127 right now that you can get it. You will get the skills stuff when I am done with it, but it is everything else is ready. You've got all of the exercise demos, all of the videos, all of the workouts, the mobility drills, the cardio workouts, the nutrition plans. Just, you know, I have to say I'm extremely, extremely proud of this program, and I really think it's going to it's a big leap forward over version 2.0, which was already the best mountain bike training program on the market. So heading into this off season, you know, if you guys are looking for something to do to get better with, that is the paint by numbers, just follow me plan in order to totally change your riding and transform yourself into a better rider. So be sure and check that out if you haven't done that already. So that about does it for this podcast. I'm going to try and get out for another ride today. I have a tradition of going on a mountain bike ride over on Thanksgiving Day, and yesterday I was definitely pushing the point a little bit. It was pretty stinking cold, but me and one of my riding buddies decided to get out anyways. And I love riding. A bad day riding beats a good day doing just about anything else. But it is hard to be fast and fluid when you can't feel your fingers in your face. So it's definitely a different experience. But it's warming up today, so I'm going to try to get out for another ride. So hope you guys are getting a chance to get out and enjoy your holiday weekend as well, for those of you who are getting a holiday weekend. And get out and ride and enjoy it, or get in the gym and train so that you can get ready for the next time you can get out and ride and enjoy it. And I will talk to you guys in the next podcast.